Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we interview immigration attorneys and two undocumented young people who have lived in the U.S. for most of their lives and are currently protected from deportation by President Obama's executive action known as DACA. Also, a pending Supreme Court action may threaten U.S. deferral from deportation for about 5 million people living and working in the United States. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we interview immigration attorneys and two undocumented young people who have lived in the U.S. for most of their lives. They are currently protected from deportation by President Obama's first Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. It's an executive action. Another is called DAPA, a Deferred Action for Parental Accountability. That's now being examined by the U.S. Supreme Court. So today on the program, we're going to be talking about issues surrounding immigration, and we are joined by a number of expert guests. And here is Peter to introduce them to you. Peter?
We're joined today by two immigration attorneys. Barbara Pinto is an immigration senior staff attorney at Central Legal de la Raza. She works at the Central Legal, involves detained or removed defense, as well as various affirmation petitions. She is also a supervising attorney, Central Legal's DACA and DAPA project. She's an immigrant herself and grew up in San Francisco. Joining us also is Chris Korosky. He's an immigration attorney and My American Dreams project director. He's a graduate of the University of California at Berkeley Law School and is a former counsel of the U.S. Department of Justice in Washington, D.C. Also joining us today is Victor Escobar, an immigration paralegal. He's a My American Dreams volunteer and immigrated to the U.S. when he was 13 years old, graduated in political science with a minor in pre-law from Chico State, and will be attending Hastings Law School in the fall. So, Barbara, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And are you there, Christopher?
Yes, I am, Peter.
You're our immigration attorney from up in Santa Rosa area. And Victor Escobar, welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
It's great to have you.
Thanks for having us.
Victor presented at our Social Justice Week on DAPA rights and what was happening there at Sonoma State, and I was very impressed with his presentation, so we've invited him in. And Victor, we're going to start with you. And our first question is to talk about yourself. You came to the United States when you were 11 years old. What was that like, and what's happened since?
I actually came to the U.S. when I was 13 years old, but a lot has happened since then. I remember growing up, and I just didn't see myself as having a future or any hope whatsoever because of my status. And I grew up in a very conservative area in Redding, California. So basically the concern of some of folks that don't agree with the implementation is that it's going to be bad for the economy, and we're going to be touching upon that. But a lot has happened since I came into the United States in 2001. There was a student movement that began roughly around 2010 that basically inspired a whole lot of dreamers to step forward and despite their status and help passed some executive actions by President Obama, and it's been amazing. It's been a total roller coaster. We have a lot of folks that are very enthused about this project, My American Dreams, and I mean, it's a terrific project that we're working with a public broadcasting station.
So you're one of how many people in the United States that fit the dreamer category?
About 750,000 to 1.2 million. What we've seen is that about 750,000 or so have applied for it, but there are 1.2 million folks that are qualified for this program.
And these are young people who were brought to the United States by their parents.
Correct.
And have lived here, grew up here, went to school here. Mm-hmm. And what are some of the restrictions that you experienced?
Well, they have to qualify. I'm a DACA recipient myself. We have to pass through an extensive background check. And we submit our fingerprints with the United States Department of Homeland Security and USCIS Immigration Services. And we have to pay our taxes and lot of other requirements. If we would have had a felony, we will not qualify for this program. Three misdemeanors also disqualify you for the program, and there are several other requirements. And, I mean, part of the reason is that you have to have graduated from a high school or be enrolled in college or served in the U.S. military. So it's a very expensive
So deferred action for childhood arrivals is 4 years old now, is that correct?
It was started in 2012. It was announced in July 2012.
So, and that gave some relief to these million-plus young people who live in the U.S., grew up here.
Correct.
What was it like growing up without that protection?
Oh, my God. It was very scary. I understand I came here without documents. And, you know, just the psyche that accompanies that, you believe that you are not contributing to society. You don't have a right to be here. And, I mean, you know, it was a negative impact on my psyche. I was just very depressed a lot of the time. When I started looking at the studies, that some of the studies we'll be touching upon today, I actually found out that the undocumented workforce in the United States contributes tremendously to the economy, trillions and trillions of dollars. We contribute taxes, et cetera, et cetera. But I grew up in Redding, California, and I went through high school. I never got into trouble. I used to be in the swim team. I was one of the best swimmers in my high school and in our year-long college swim team. And at the moment when I was supposed to go into college, I just didn't see a point in going to college because simply I could not have worked without a work permit or any immigration status, and it was very depressing. So I had to get two jobs, go to school full time, and make it happen. When I graduated from Shasta College with an Associates of Arts, I went on to Chico State, where at the time there wasn't the California Dream Act, which grants some undocumented students state funds to get scholarships in California, which is only about 0.1% of the total budget for scholarship students in California, for college students in California. So I, again, had to get the jobs. I had to commute to Chico State. And basically, I had to make it happen. I had to, you know, work hard to go to school and basically pursue the American dream that many folks come here for. The week of my graduation in 2009, I was pulled over for driving without a driver's license. And what that meant was that there was a program that was called Secure Communities at the time, which basically allows police departments to report to Immigration and Customs Enforcement if there is someone that they suspect that might have undocumented status in the United States. So I was detained for driving over the speed limit. The police officer didn't ask me to get out of the car. He just shouted at me, holding onto his holster and his guns, he'd get off the car. And I, you know, as a college student, I didn't think there was any reason for me not to get off the car. So, you know, trying to abide by the law as much as I could, I stepped out of the car. Police officer ends up questioning me and puts me in detention that takes me to jail. And then 2 days later, Immigration and Customs Enforcement put up a hold so that they would not release me. I was in deportation proceedings for about 3 years in the detention center for itself for about 7 weeks. So I was able to stop my deportation, but I mean, the system is so incredible. I was able to stop my deportation, but I was not able to have any status whatsoever, because there was a thing called the Morton Memo, which basically argued by the Department of Homeland Security that because there are so many folks that are undocumented, the Department of Homeland Security cannot deport every single one of them. Simply, the logistics and the resources do not allow that implementation. So I was allowed to stay in the United States without any status, basically, after I had been in court proceedings. And my case was put on hold. So I, you know, I was very depressed. I didn't want to grow up to be undocumented. I started studying to go to CSULA. I commuted about 3 hours daily, actually 4 hours in the bus, and just to get a master's in business administration. But then DACA came into effect. It was just amazing. I wanted to help my folks, my undocumented community, to, you know, step out of the shadows, because I experienced this firsthand. So I started studying for the LSAT, and lo and behold, after studying for about 4 months, I didn't have a score high enough to get into any school. And the thing about being undocumented is that you cannot get help from the federal government. So if you're a graduate student in California or in anywhere in the United States and you're undocumented, you cannot get any assistance to pay for your tuition. The average law school in California, annual tuition, you're looking around 40 $37,000. And so there was just no way for me to go just with an average score. So I kept studying for about a year and a half. Every single day I would study for about 8 hours. My eyes would get red. And my wife was very supportive. And finally, I decided to apply to 14 different law schools. Hastings took me in, which is a top-tier law school, in 2014. Unfortunately, my score was not high enough so I could pay for the tuition. So I had to postpone that. And after doing a whole lot of resourcing, et cetera, and just trying to put it together, I reapplied in 2015. I should be attending Hastings in 2016.
And, wow, that's a story.
Yeah.
We're also joined here in studio by Barbara Pinto, immigration staff attorney at Centro Legal de la Raza. And before we go further, could you briefly tell our listeners what is deferred action for childhood arrivals, these executive actions, and also, so DACA, right? And then also DAPA, right? This is the deferred action for parental accountability. Tell our listeners exactly what these are.
Of course. In June 2012, Obama made an announcement, and it was an executive action to sort of protect these children and young adults that are in the United States in order to help them be more integrated into this society. And so what DACA allowed, it has various requirements. You have to show that you entered the United States before age 16. Right now it has an age gap, so you have to be born after. At the time it was announced, you have to be under the age of 31. And like Victor mentioned, there are also other requirements that you must meet and an extensive background check. And what DACA allows, it's not lawful status, but it's basically a deferral of deportation, so a deferred action. It protects you against deportation. It also gives you, if you're granted deferred action, a work permit so you can work lawfully. What that means is that with that, you can also get a Social Security number. In certain states, you can also obtain a driver's license and an ID. And depending on the states, there are other benefits that come from it. Definitely bringing this population out of the shadows is the main benefit that this program has had on this undocumented population.
And we're talking about 11 million people in the U.S. who are undocumented, and how many are young people who really grew up here and have lived here for a long time.
Right. There are millions in the United States that includes parents, that includes young adults, you know, a wide array of people that are undocumented in the United States. And then the other part of it, so in November 2014, Obama announced sort of like a second part of this executive action. And so it expanded the DACA program, removed the age cap. So as long as you entered before age 16, it didn't matter how old you were. So you could be an older adult over. And then the other part of it was also DAPA, as you mentioned, which protected parents of citizen children and lawful permanent residents. And so DAPA and expanded DACA are the ones that are in the Supreme Court right now. And so we heard oral arguments in the case, and we're expected to receive a decision in June. And that decision will basically determine the fate of this executive action, whether Obama has the executive power to implement these programs, which would allow more individuals, so parents of citizen children, parents of lawful permanent residents, undocumented people that have been in the U.S. for more than 6 years, to protect them from deportation, to allow them to have a work permit, get a Social Security number, and with that, just all the economic benefits as well as, you know, the fear that these families live with would all benefit this community. We see a lot of clients that come in with their children that are ready to apply for DACA, but you see it with the parents that they're also sad that they're not able to benefit from anything, and they still live in fear, like, oh, you know, understanding that their child may be protected from deportation, but they're not, and in any day they could be removed. So it's a very scary feeling, and it's something that we really need for our communities.
So let's bring Christopher Korosky in on this. Christopher, you've been an immigration attorney for a quarter of a century, and the DACA provisions were a big boost for people here. If this is turned around, what will happen? I mean, at the Supreme Court, I mean, and who is pushing this? I mean, why is this even at the Supreme Court?
There's a lot of questions you raised there. One thing I want to point out is the parameters of, first of all, DACA are large. We're talking about a million young people who've already gotten a work permit and basically a future out of this law. So if you can imagine, your listeners could imagine a person growing up here like Victor, who basically has no right to work, no right to travel, no right to drive, as illustrated by his story, everything was a risk. They were living basically in the shadows. I've heard one of these young people say they had to keep the lights off at night because their parents were so afraid they'd be arrested by ICE. And suddenly, in 2012, a door opens, and they have a work permit. They have a driver's license. They can travel. They can feel like they're legally here. It's huge. The impact on these people's lives, a million lives, it's hard to comprehend. Now you look at DAPA, which is the law that was just referred to, and that's about to basically quadruple the effect of DACA. They think between 4 and 5 million people would obtain the same relief from deportation. Work permit, a sort of status here, and the impact for them and their lives is huge, but also for our community. And that's what people need to understand. When people have the right to work, when they have the right to travel, they start paying taxes. The contributions to our local economy, our local government, our national government is staggering, the economic benefit this would have if this law is allowed to go through by the Supreme Court. So that's a partial answer to your question, Peter. As far as what's at stake and who's opposing this, well, clearly there are a lot of anti-immigrant elements in this country, and they don't want the genie to get out the bottle. You know, I've been asked, well, isn't this kicking the can down the road? This is not a green card, so how can this be a solution? Well, the fact is that once you take somebody like Victor and you give him a work permit and you allow him to travel and you admit him to Hastings Law School and he becomes a lawyer, it's really hard to stuff that genie back in the bottle and say to him, whether you're Donald Trump or Ted Cruz or any other opponent of this law, we're going to take it away from you. We're going to deport you. I really don't think that's going to happen, no matter who becomes president. Now, what will happen is that the law will be disbanded. It will not be expanded. And many of these people may lose their benefits, even if they're not deported. And certainly DAPA will not be implemented. So those other 4 to 5 million people will not get the kind of relief from deportation that they potentially will if the Supreme Court does the right thing.
So, Christopher, since we have you here on the line, there's somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 million undocumented workers in the United States. I mean, this affects a really significant number of people, correct?
It's hard to fathom the scope of the human benefit that this law would affect. I see about 1,000 families a year, about 5 to 7 a day, and almost every single one of them would, in some way or other, would benefit from DAPA. Either a family member, all their family members, cousin, nephew, father, mother, every single person practically who comes through my door would benefit. And then, of course, the corollary benefits for their children. I think that part is totally lost in the discussion. We're not only talking about 5 million adults primarily who would benefit from this law, but what about their children? Even if they're U.S. citizens growing up here, if you have small children or even teenagers growing up with an undocumented parent, if those parents get deported, generally speaking, the whole family goes back. So it's really 5 million times 3, 4, 5 in terms of number of the people affected by this. Because if you truly try to deport these 5 million, you know, you're really sending back to Mexico or whatever country they're from a lot more than that, because their children will come with them.
Now, I'd just like to add something here, Chris. It was estimated that 1 out of every 4 kids in Hispanic family had undocumented parents, and that if you will grab their parents and you will put them on deportation proceedings, it's also estimated that these kids will end up in the foster care system. And that alone, you'll be looking at around $138 million that will be spent trying to cover that care. In addition, I mean, there are also the economic benefits of DACA and DAPA to the U.S. economy. There was a study by the Pew Research Center. It's a nonpartisan group, and they estimated that the cumulative increase in the income of all Americans, not just Hispanic Americans or white Americans, Asian Americans, all Americans, you're looking at around $46 billion in the first 5 years, and $124 billion in the next 10 years. Also, there will be a cumulative increase in gross domestic product, or GDP, and you're looking at around $86 billion in the first 5 years to $110 billion. So you're not looking at it simply just benefiting the DACA and DAPA recipients. You're looking at benefiting the entire U.S. population as a whole. And, I mean, there are even other conservative authorities that are in favor for DACA and DAPA. They're just not very much repeated on mainstream media. For example, Holtz Eakin, who was the leading Republican economist, he advised John McCain's presidential campaign in 2008. In 2013, he released a study arguing that comprehensive immigration reform will boost the economy, growth, and reduce long-term deficits by $2.5 trillion. So let me repeat that again, $2.5 trillion. This is something that will benefit not just folks that are here without documents, not just folks that are Hispanic or racial, no. It will benefit the entire economy.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking today, well, several of our guests today are talking about DACA and DAPA. Executive actions, or talking about the status of immigration. The voice you heard just last was Victor Escobar, an immigrant paralegal and graduate in political science from Chico State University. We're also joined on the phone by Christopher Karosky, an attorney, and we are joined in studio by Barbara Pinto, immigration staff attorney at Centro Legal de la Raza. And Barbara Pinto, I wanted to go to you about the way in which, and Christopher alluded to some of this in terms of what we're hearing in terms of how this topic is discussed in the United States. And certainly I'd like to point to the issues of media, particularly corporate media, and how corporate media tend to frame immigration discussions. They're framed as a debate. But what we see in the corporate media is actually highly mythological. It's not very accurate. Particularly, could you address issues of immigration enforcement? There's this notion in the U.S. that it doesn't work. There's also another idea that the border is porous, particularly the southern border, right? In the United States, this overarching sort of racist mentality going, whether you go back to the slave trade or the Mexican-American War and so forth, we won't open up that can of worms. But the point is there's always talk about building a border fence on the south, nowhere else. Can you talk about these particular myths about immigration in the U.S.?
Of course, and that's a really good point. And this issue really should be framed as a humane issue, especially, and we see it now again with, for example, the migrant families that are coming from Central America and Mexico fleeing extreme violence. We're seeing it as we need to ramp up with enforcement, and if we don't, then that won't deter people and more people will come. But instead of seeing it as a refugee crisis, you know, it's happening. We see it in Europe and it's happening here as well, but we're not labeling it as such. And, you know, immigration is administrative law. It's administrative law, but the way enforcement happens is very much criminalized. And so, you know, as Victor was mentioned, many immigrants are detained and mostly in criminal facilities. So in jail, in prisons, where ICE contracts and uses that as facility and bed space to house immigrants. So even though it is an administrative procedure, many immigrants are detained at the border, are detained within the United States. And we see that a lot also even with asylum seekers that are fleeing violence, that want to seek protection in the United States. They're also detained for several months. And so we need to figure out a way of how to sort of fix this broken system and make it more of a refugee crisis, a humane crisis, and really focus on the families and children that have lived in the United States for several years. They're already part of our community and part of our network.
If I could add something really quick, Mickey, again, you know, some folks say that if you grant this DACA or DAPA, some people will start pouring through the border, and that's just absolutely not true. There was another study by the Pew Research Center as well, and again, it's a nonpartisan group. And in 2008, there was an estimated 12.2 million undocumented folks here in the United States. And, you know, in DACA was announced in 2012, and since if these folks were correct, you will expect just millions of people trying to come in through the border, and that's just simply not true. As of now, we have 10.8 million undocumented immigrants in the United States, and the numbers continue to drop.
So, Barbara Pinto, just briefly before we take a break here, we hear in the United States arguments against legalizing unauthorized immigrants, and you're arguing from a humane perspective, and we are hearing Victor here saying that it's not this porous border, and immigrants maybe, the idea here is the immigrants take jobs from Americans. Again, that's kind of another myth that we hear.
Briefly, what's your argument then in favor of legalizing unauthorized immigrants?
Oh, there's so many.
Yes, I know.
I feel like we could have a whole
we could. Well, let's just begin that, and then we're going to come back and be joined by another guest. But just hint on some of these things.
Well, they're, like I mentioned, they're part of our community. They're here working. They're paying taxes. They're contributing to society. They're just living in fear and being exploited in different areas of our society as well, whether in the workforce or another area. So we need to bring these people out of the shadows, and we need to integrate them into the society. They already see this country as their own. We need to include them and make them feel like they are part of this country. And of course,
can I add a quick thought to that? I know you want to take a break, but very briefly.
This is Christopher Karoski.
Most of the people we see and most of the undocumented immigrants are here 10, 15, 20 years. That's the average. And I think that's something not understood. And what I find so offensive about the anti-immigration reform attitude and some of the mentality of the people who want to deport everyone is that really what we've done for some of these people who are here 20, 25 years, and it's really common that they are undocumented here, is that we're changing the rules in the middle of the game. You know, in the early 90s and the mid-90s, when most of these people came, or even the late 90s, basically our Customs and Border Patrol people laughed about their entry. I had many clients who told me I was caught, and they said, oh, better luck tomorrow. We wanted these people here, and we wanted them for their labor. And now, just because of 9/11 and all the ways that that's been politically manipulated, and we all know how the anti-immigrant political groups are using this tool to rally their base.
Well, some high-profile candidates are really speaking to these things
and using fear to get votes. And the point is, now we're saying, oh, you came in 20 years ago, raised a family, your kids go to our schools, maybe you bought a house, you have a job for 10, 15 years, and we wanted you back then, but now we've changed our mind, so get out of our country. That's what I find most offensive. If there are people in our country who want to build a wall, that's not something I agree with, but I understand, okay, we want to stop further unlawful immigration. But what about the people that we basically invited in 20 years ago, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, to try and deport them and their kids now is grossly unfair. And that's what I think is lost a lot in the debate over immigration.
That's the voice of Christopher Karoski, immigration attorney. He's project director at My American Dreams. We've also been joined here at the beginning of the show today by Victor Escobar, immigration paralegal. And also we've been joined by attorney Barbara Pinto. She's an immigration staff attorney at Centro Legal de la Raza. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We will continue our conversation and add another voice after this musical break. Stay with us. Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's show, we're talking with immigration attorneys. We're talking with two undocumented young people who have lived in the U.S. for most of their lives and are currently protected from deportation by something called DACA. We're also talking about another executive action called DAPA that would affect parents of these folks. And we're joined by a number of guest immigration attorneys and so forth. And we are now going to introduce another voice to the program. And here is Peter to tell you.
Maria de Los Angeles Cornejo is an instructor at Pratt Institute of Art in New York. She's a American Dreams volunteer. She immigrated to the U.S. when she was 11 years old, graduated with a master's degree from Yale. She went to college up at Santa Rosa at the JC there. She's working on a Ph.D. in pre-Columbian art history and as a mentor to young art students and hosts many in studios and has a showing in California and New York. Maria, are you there with us?
Yes, thank you for having me.
Well, it's wonderful to hear your voice.
I go by Maria de Los Angeles, my artist name.
Oh, okay, wonderful. Tell us your story about coming here at 11 years of age and how you managed to get a master's degree at Yale and are working on a Ph.D. and become a full artist in your own right.
Well, my family had to immigrate for economic reasons to the United States when I was 11 years old. I'm the oldest of 8 children, but then we came in, we were about 5 children. We were drugged with Tylenol and passed through the border by a woman who pretended that we were her kids. And, well, that's how we arrived. And at the time in Mexico, I was in second grade. I was stuck with all of my siblings in the same second grade level. And when I got here, I started in seventh grade that same year at Lawrence Cook Middle School in Santa Rosa.
And how was your journey to New York? I mean, how did you end up at Yale, and how were you able to pay for that?
I went to LC Allen High School, and then I went to Santa Rosa Junior College, where I really got a really fantastic education. From there, I applied to about 11 schools, and I believe I got into 9 of them, 9 universities, and Pratt Institute gave me a half tuition scholarship. And in order to go there, that summer of 2011, I had an exhibition where I sold work to many people in this community to pay for the rest of my my tuition and costs. I graduated in 2013 from Pratt with a bachelor's in painting, and I was accepted into Yale University, where I graduated this 2015 with my master's in painting and printmaking.
And are you currently under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA?
Yes, I am. I was very disappointed when we didn't get the DREAM Act to go through. And I do have DACA, and that's why I'm a university professor.
You're certainly contributing to American society in some very big ways. And your entire family is here, and you have brothers and sisters that were born here, so they're full citizens. Are you still worried about DACA being not allowed?
Well, of course, and I think DACA not being allowed is a crime against people because it contributes oppression. And I think that if DACA got removed, I couldn't be a university professor. I couldn't help students find their way. And I am currently applying for advanced parole. I have already submitted my application to go to Italy to study Jacopo Tintoretto for the month there, first week of July. So I'm excited to see whether my application is going to be approved.
And before the executive order was released, you were going through school, but you were constantly in danger. As Victor here told us, how he was picked up and held in deportation prison for a while. Did you worry about that growing up?
I mean, yes. I mean, the police would pull us over. They would take my mother's car away, impound it. Anything we did, if something happened to us once we were working and this woman wouldn't pay us, and she said, well, we're not going to, my whole family, and I was a kid, I was about 12 at the time. She's like, I'm not going to pay you and you can't do anything about it. So it's at every level. You wouldn't talk about it in school. No one knew I was undocumented until about maybe 2 years ago when I started to be more vocal about it.
Maria, thank you very much for being on the show, sharing your story with us. We think this is a very important topic that needs to be brought out and covered widely in the U.S. Thank you a lot for being there.
Thank you.
So, Barbara Pinto, let's go to you. And we just heard a pretty amazing story Victor, your story that you shared at the beginning of the program is, you know, equally amazing. It definitely contradicts and flies in the face of the mythological propaganda that we hear from corporate media, right? The very often very divisive messages. And as I mentioned earlier, when Christopher Karofsky was speaking, I had momentarily interjected that this is coming from the upper echelons of the American political party system. I mean, there are major candidates, well, particularly for the Republican Party, that are, you know, openly hostile to immigrants, and particularly Mexico, from Mexican immigrants, Trump being most notorious in that regard. But Barbara Pinto, and then Chris Karofsky, maybe you want to dump in here too, really lay out, you know, why are DACA and DAPA so important for our communities? Not just, again, for those people, but obviously the people affected by immigration status are the ones most impacted by these things. But can you talk about both that and for why the DACA and DAPA are good for the communities at large? Barbara Pinto, let's start with you.
Of course, and we just heard two really good reasons why it's important. You know, especially for children that have obtained DACA, these are youth that have been educated in the United States. They're raised like Americans. You know, why not benefit from their talents and skills and abilities? Why deport them and take away from that, right, from the United States? So that's also really another really important reason why we need those things, and we need DACA and DAPA, and it's very important. You know, I have a personal connection. My family and I immigrated to the United States when I was 2 years old, and my story sort of exemplifies why our immigration system is so broken. We lived undocumented for many years, for more than 20 years, and I sometimes think about that it was easier for me to, it was faster for me to go to college, go to law school, be barred in California, one of the hardest states to be admitted into the bar, to practice before and do all those things before I was eligible to become a U.S. citizen. And I did everything by the book, and we hear a lot of rhetoric about just get in line and wait your turn. Well, we have a broken system, and that just doesn't work. And if you do wait in line and wait your turn, then it ends up being more than a 20, 25-year wait. So I was able to become an attorney, get barred, and practice before I was eligible to become a citizen. And so that's just something that shouldn't be happening, because like me and like Victor and like Maria de Los Angeles, there are many families and community members that are here that are contributing, and we just want the country that we call home to call us American and to call us part of their community as well.
Indeed, Barbara Pinto, indeed. Christopher Karofsky, you want to jump in here and add a bit to this, the importance of DACA and DAPA?
Absolutely. Thank you. First of all, you know, as these two stories illustrate, the contribution of the young people who've gotten their status through DACA, the Dreamers, as I like to say, is huge. I mean, some of them pick our food. We have the stereotype that undocumented people are out there picking vegetables and fruit, and that's true to some extent. They work at restaurants. They build our homes, but they also design our homes. They're architects. They're computer software engineers. They teach college, like Maria. They work in the medical field. I've seen lots of Dreamers who are nurses or nurses' assistants, and even, yes, lawyers and legal assistants, paralegals like Victor, soon to be a lawyer after he graduates from Hastings. So these people are not, as the stereotype or the mythology, as you worded it, simply illiterate laborers who don't assimilate to our society. That's such a fallacy. And we're doing a Dreamers film project that's been alluded to. We call it My American Dreams. I have to put a quick plug in for it. We broadcast these films on PBS. They're being distributed nationwide this month. And basically what we do with these films is we tell these stories. One of them, by the way, is about Maria. You can watch it online on our website, myamericandreams.org. But it tells the stories of these young people and how they contribute to society in such a powerful way, so that the average American can see this and hopefully destroy some of these fallacies that exist out there about who is undocumented. And by the way, the same is true of their parents. I have people who are undocumented who own stores and construction businesses and even employ lots of people. So this mythology, as you put it, of, you know, the undocumented immigrant not making a major contribution to our society, as Trump alluded to, you know, calling them criminals,
It's absolutely false. In fact, statistics show, and I can provide them to you, that undocumented population commits far less crimes than our average American population. So these fallacies have to be destroyed. And our film project, that's one of its primary goals, is to tell these stories to American voters so that they really understand the other side of the story when they listen to the anti-immigrant rhetoric that is profusive in our media.
Christopher, it's my understanding that it's not illegal to walk across the U.S. border. If you're deported and you come back, that's illegal. But for the most part, people came here, they took work. You talk about the 90s when it was pretty wide open and people could come up here. Farm labor was needed vastly. But we always had these barriers, like being able to get a driver's license. And so people, if they had to drive to work or get somewhere, they'd be stopped and their cars would be confiscated. Maria talked about how that happened to her family and her mom. And this was a really big problem up in the Santa Rosa area for a long time, and all over. Thousands and thousands of automobiles were stolen from people because they were.
And most of those people, by the way, Peter, were put into deportation proceedings because we represent a lot of them. And some of them are still in deportation proceedings just because they were driving their kids to school or going to the store to get groceries.
Or they were stopped in one of the traffic stops where they're supposedly looking for people who are drunk. But they end up, the reports are end up 15 people, cars were impounded because they didn't have licenses, and they found one drunk, maybe. That seems to be what happened. So it was the function of that seemed to be really just to grab people's and steal their cars. And the tow truck companies loved it because they'd take these cars, they'd impound them for 30 days, and you couldn't get it back because it was more in fees than it was to the value of the car. It's really, really an amazing part.
If I could add a couple things
quick. Go ahead, Victor.
I used to live in Ventura County, and, you know, I understand that some of these undocumented folks are not attorneys, and although, you know, as myself, hopefully in the future I'll be, and we have a vast number of us that are educated. But even though along the lines of just farm workers in Ventura County alone, what we found out was there were 90% of these folks that were farm workers were undocumented. And in Ventura County, that's the main economic driver, the farm workers, agriculture. And, you know, so it's being estimated that if you will have undeport all these folks, that simply the economy will just in the farm sector.
These are essential jobs.
Yeah, correct. And nobody will step in to take over these jobs. When Georgia was trying to emulate Arizona papers law, SB 1070, I believe it was, in 2011, there was a study that found out that even though a lot of folks got the stuff and left Georgia, nobody was filling in their jobs, and they were losing millions and billions and billions of dollars in the economy. They put out flyers all the way to Florida to have folks come over and pick up the crops because, you know, if you're picking up the crops and you're really good at it, some of these folks can make $25 an hour. So imagine, a lot of people are complaining that they cannot find jobs. There are flyers out there advertising for jobs that can help you earn $25 an hour, and still, nobody came in to pick up those crops. So, you know, we are essential to this economy. When I say we, I am talking about undocumented immigrants, and people just don't see that. I think it's very elusive, and, you know, we're needed in this economy. We help construct the United States. I mean, you know.
We heard a little bit ago, Attorney Barbara Pinto talking about playing by the rules and how long that it takes to achieve your goals, your objectives in terms of being welcomed or accepted legally in the society. We're going to take a musical break. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We'll continue this conversation. Stay with us.
is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we've been talking about immigration, deportation. We've been talking about executive actions, DACA and DAPA. We've had wonderful guests, attorneys, and people in the country undocumented telling their stories. And Peter Phillips, where would you like to take things now?
Well, we'll start with Barbara, and then we'll go back to Victor, but and probably Christopher, too. But I want to really address at the end of the show here, What should be done for the 11 million people who are living here undocumented? Obviously, it's a big problem. There's major contributions being made by these folks. And comprehensive immigration reform seems to be necessary. But what would that entail, Barbara Pinto?
We really need immigration reform. Like I mentioned, our immigration system is really broken. There are a lot of things really wrong with it. And like I mentioned, there are millions of people here that we just need to get out of the shadows and integrate into our community. We really need support from both parties, from both parts of Congress, from the future president to get that on board. There have been different proposals in Congress. We've had sort of a piecemeal approach where we've seen just the DREAM Act by itself, which would grant lawful permanent residence or a green card to undocumented youth that have been living in the United States for quite some time. And we've seen bills that were more broader and more inclusive that did cover more of a reform to the system, but also try to get as many people documented and give them lawful status.
If I could add a couple of things, when people think of immigration reform, they think of an amnesty. When they think of an amnesty, they think of something that is just a freebie that people are going to come in and they're going to become citizens overnight. That's simply not true. When we were looking at comprehensive immigration reform in 2014, there was a real probability that this will pass Congress. We had 218 votes to pass the House. We had, I believe it was 90 votes to pass the Senate. I'm blanking out right now. But we had the votes to get comprehensive immigration reform, and it was comprehensive. It had a lot of very strict requirements. I mean, you hear some folks like Donald Trump, build a wall, right? Build a wall around the border. You know, if you have a wall, people are going to go through it or under it or over it. So, I mean, but if you would have had comprehensive immigration reform, you would have over 38,000 Again, 38,000 Border Patrol agents along the border. And actually, it was being estimated that every single one of these folks were to hold hands. You will have a human wall. That is without adding that you will have technological drones looking at it, sensors, cameras. So again, if you want to really help protect the security, which again, we're not destroying this nation, just get comprehensive immigration reform passed. And, you know, it is just so simply overwhelming to hear all these things from folks that are not informed. So we're trying to inform some folks here. But, I mean, it was a 13-year wait for people that were undocumented to become U.S. citizens. And before that, they will have been granted registered provisional immigrants status. What that meant was that all the triggers, such as building a 700-mile fence across the U.S. border with Mexico, will have had to occur before they could apply to become citizens. Again, 38,400 Border Patrol agents will have to be instituted. You will have employment electronic verification systems implemented across the U.S., electronic tracking systems. These folks that were applying for this, if you have to pay their taxes that they own, they couldn't have any prior felonies. They had to pay a fine. They had to have continual employment for the entire period. If they weren't employed for more than 60 days during that entire 13-year period, they will not be able to qualify for this. So, you know, when you hear of people saying build a wall, that's just simply not going to solve the problem. The bill that was actually trying to expand the number of people that come in under visas for tech visas. You were looking at Google, IBM, because simply the workforce that we have in the United States does not meet the requirements that we have to drive our economy. We need immigrants here.
I'm going to interject quickly. Again, you know, I don't think building a wall is a prudent thing to do, but I always like to separate that issue, which is border security, from the issue of how you treat the people who are already here. Those are really two separate things. And people like Trump and Cruz and the other anti-immigrant opponents, they lump them together. And I really think it would be important for your listeners and for the public to treat them differently. I mean, does it make sense to take people like Victor and Maria, who've grown up here, who, as President Obama said, grown up pledging allegiance to our flag, going to our schools, contributing to our community, and deport a million of these young people? Does it make sense to take people, as I said, who on the average are here 15, 20 years, because I see them every day, and you're going to deport them and their spouses and their children, 5 million of them? I mean, I think our country's better than that. I think we have to be better than that. And we can build walls, we can build electronic border security, but let's be humane to the people that we essentially invited here, wanted here, utilized their labor for 10, 15, 20 years, allowed them to build families and integrate into our society, and not suddenly change the rules and deport them.
Christopher,
I think our country is better than that.
Christopher Karosky, we only have a couple minutes left here, and one, economic impacts, of course. We touched on this a little bit where some of our guests here have talked about the impact of DACA and DAPA economically. The study for Center for American Progress, there was a report that they issued about DACA and DAPA recipients earning higher wages and contributing to the economy. I mean, again, that's certainly something that goes to the second of your two main points, right, in separating those two issues. And that's certainly something that we hear very little about in the corporate media.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, statistics can be used for various things to argue both sides of the coin. But just think of it logically. Just think of it logically. If you've got a million people like Victor and Maria, if you've got 5 million people like their parents who suddenly, for all their lives here, have never been able to pay taxes, really. They've never been able to travel. They've never been able to work openly and compete in the marketplace fairly. And now they suddenly will. I mean, that's going to have a huge economic impact on our society, definitely with our tax base and our local communities and our federal government. Everybody admits that. Nobody can deny the huge impact this would have. But just it would have many, many ripple effects and benefits for every segment of our economy when you have people paying taxes suddenly, when you have people who are able to travel, able to work openly, you know, and that's absolutely undeniable. So that's another argument for immigration reform. I think we have touched on many, and I keep coming back to the humanity of it. It's really wrong to take millions and millions of people and deport them after you've led them on to the idea that they're going to have a life here. Essentially what these people are advocating who get up and propose deporting 10 million people.
Not only is it wrong in the sense of the people who are here, but the North American Free Trade Agreement pushed millions of people in Mexico off farms and into the cities in desperate economic situations that has carried forward to this day. So, you know, commerce and trucks and money can move, and our companies can put companies in Mexico and pay lower wages. But here, it creates economic problems, and then we blame the immigrants. That's simply wrong. So I want to wrap this up and let Barbara have about a minute to kind of summarize. And we'll get back to Victor, and then we got to end our show. Barbara?
Well, thank you for having us. You know, I just wanted to say in summary, we really need comprehensive immigration reform, and we really need to protect families that are here, integrate them into our society, and we need to treat this as a humane issue and demystify the myths.
Victor?
Well, again, you know, I hope we could somehow convince you that comprehensive immigration reform is needed. But not only that, for all those folks that would like to help somehow, we have a tool here. We are in partnership with a public broadcasting station. We have a project going on live nationwide. We're creating these professionally crafted videos. And we have a website. It's www.myamericandreams.org. You can go in, check it out. You can help us spread the message. You can help us screen these videos in your town. Help us get those videos in your TV stations. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for joining us. That was Victor Escobar, immigration paralegal. We've also been joined by Barbara Pinto, immigration senior staff attorney at Centro Legal de la Raza. Christopher Karosky, thank you for joining us, My American Dreams project director. We also heard from artist Maria de Los Angeles.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own my special.
That does it for the Project Censored show today. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest. Our engineer is Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored show airs on over 40 stations around the United States. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time. Without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollar bills. We won, we got the love of just our brothers and our sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We won, we got that love of just your brothers and your sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We got the love of just our brothers and our sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We got the love of just our brothers and our sisters. The people organized can build the kind of future.
Think about crimes perpetrated. alibi disguised under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys. And the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity, citizens. And the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love, we flip the brothers and our sisters.